to our next to the last session in this track. We're going to talk about moving your full trust code to the cloud using repeatable patterns and best practices. I'll tell you a little bit about myself. My name is Steve Walker. There's my Twitter handle. I'm a senior PM on the Office 365 customer adoption team. I focus on developer extensibility and app dev scenarios across the Office suite of servers and clients. I worked a number of years in SharePoint as a SharePoint Ranger in consulting services for Microsoft, doing both US-based and global delivery projects. I now lend my voice of the developer to the engineering teams. I also run our NDA developer preview programs within Microsoft. So, a little bit of the agenda. First, we will cover why apps. I'll talk about that a little bit. We'll cover some app basics. And then we'll talk about the top customization scenarios that we hear from customers and the challenges that they see when they look at what they've done before with full trust code and how to approach those with the app model. So first, why apps? The app proposition, they are decoupled from SharePoint. They run in the cloud or on the client, not in the same worker process as SharePoint. There's a lot, you'll hear that over and over and over again. There's a lot of benefits both to us at Microsoft and to you in that space. So they can be hosted anywhere, on any web platform, virtually anywhere in the world. They reduce friction between the SharePoint developers and the IT pros. So when we were building this version of SharePoint Online, we really were looking at how do we get to a point where we can upgrade SharePoint online very frequently without breaking and worrying about all of the customizations. So we learned from our previous experiences running our dedicated platform that we have to have a different way to do it. We can't host that full trust code. The sandbox was not a scalable model either, so thus the new app model was born. This allows us in SharePoint Online to upgrade very frequently, and we can make sure that we're not breaking your apps and your customizations. And if you translate that even to an on-prem world where you are actually running your servers in your environment for your company, you can gain those same types of benefits. So every time your admins want to go up, your IT pros want to go upgrade your SharePoint farm, and you're a developer and you've got all those customizations, you've got a bunch of work to go do now to go validate that your customizations aren't breaking and that we didn't change things in the server object model that have broken you. So there's a lot of benefits to it on-prem as well. It's also a lightweight developer story. This is actually my favorite part about this. I no longer have to carry around the 30-pound laptop with all my VMs running on it. So I love that. Also, the customizations are based on web standards, so the investments that you make to learn this are not just applicable to Office. And if you've been developing on these other platforms, this becomes much more familiar to you. And also, apps are discoverable. So I think we've covered that in a lot of the sessions already. So we'll talk a little bit about app basics, the different app hosting options that you have. So you have provider hosted and you have SharePoint hosted. And you'll notice intentionally there's a big hole in the middle that used to be auto-hosted. That is no longer an option. We don't allow you to create any auto-hosted sites anymore. So if you are running auto-hosted sites, auto-hosted apps, you should be looking to move them to provider-hosted as soon as possible. I think we've covered the remote API in about every one of these sessions. So, underscore API is the new alias for this. So when you're surfacing apps, from a user experience perspective, you can build immersive full page apps. You can build app parts, which are analogous to web parts. You can build extension apps, and you can build SharePoint dialogue. This is really talking about the user experience aspects of it. You can also use the app model, and I'm going to show you a little bit about this in other ways as well, even in like console apps and PowerShell and things of that nature. So, so when we look at the common customization requests, for some reason, everybody yells at me about SharePoint timer jobs. Like, That's one of the first things they say. What am I going to do about my timer jobs? Well, you're not going to run them in SharePoint Online. SharePoint timer jobs are very powerful because they have full farm ad. They run under the admin account. You get that code in there. You can do anything you want in the farm. They're also notoriously hard to debug and troubleshoot. If you've ever tried to attach to a timer job in a SharePoint farm, that can be quite challenging. But I'm going to show you a pattern that you can use to implement the same type of behavior, but using a different approach. There's a lot of different scheduling engines out there. You know, Windows Task Scheduler running on a server. We have web jobs in Azure now, which are actually pretty cool. We'll show you some approaches to, and it says delegate controls, but really what this means is I want to modify or extend the out-of-the-box UI in a way that's considered app model without having to actually unghost my master pages and, you know, start hacking those things around and putting different controls on it. Site templates and provisioning, that one comes up consistently. I probably should have put that at number two, right behind timer jobs. Everybody wants to be able to pre-configure sites when they're provisioned. I'm going to show you some approaches that we're promoting for that. And then OneDrive governance and branding. So we'll talk a little bit about that. So they want to be able, you know, you want to be able to provide some kind of a governance to the OneDrive environment, or you want to brand people's OneDrive sites with a custom theme. And then whatever time we have left, I'm going to go through some other ones out of the patterns and practices GitHub repo. So every one of the things that I'm going to show you today, the code is out there. If you go to aka.ms/officedevpnp, that'll redirect you over to GitHub. This is where we're publishing a lot of samples and open source. We've also got a lot of interesting contributions from the community as well. So if you think you have a great pattern, you think you have a great bit of code that would help others, we do take pull requests in this thing. And we're seeing more and more involvement from the community. So I'll show you some of the stuff the community actually contributed that wasn't just Microsoft people. It's actually pretty cool. So, all right, so let's talk about timer jobs via apps. The first thing you need to think of is what you're trying to do exposed through CSOM or REST. So we made a lot of CSOM updates in 2013. We added the ability to use client-side object model against user profiles, social, taxonomy, .. There was a huge investment in that in the 2013 time space because we knew that if we're going to go to this app model, we had to expose those things through client-side methods. You'll want to determine what authentication approach you'll use. If you use OAuth, it will require a web experience to trust the app, but I will show you an interesting little workaround for that. Though I'm going to actually just show you a console app. You can use a service account with credentials. I mean, that's not an atypical pattern that I see. You can use the SharePoint Online credentials in SharePoint Online, but then you will still have to worry about managing the, you know, the password expirations and such. And then as far as scheduling them, you can run them in on-prem servers, or you can run them in the cloud. You can run them, you know, scheduling engine of your choice. Basically, I'm just going to show you how to make a console app that talks to SharePoint, and then you can figure out where you're going to go schedule and run that thing and what the frequency is. We do have a cool new feature in Windows Azure websites. It's called Web Jobs, and basically it's a scheduling engine that runs in Azure, and you can upload your console apps to there. Got the wrong demo there. So, what I'm going to do now, actually, hold on. All right. So every bit of this, just to show you where this stuff is coming from, if you go to the Office Dev Patterns and Practices, this is the actual sample folder. I'll go up a level and show you. We've got some components that were built by the community and by some folks at Microsoft that are useful. We've got a core component that kind of keeps us from reusing a ton of code. We've got a ton of samples in here. And then we've got scenarios, which are taking a lot of these samples and putting them together in an end-to-end scenario. And then we've got solutions, so more complete, full solutions. One of the best ones I like to point people to is actually our hybrid provisioning, to where you can provision both on-prem and in the cloud using the app model. So that one's in there. It's really cool, and you can pull it apart. So from here, I'm just going to go down to core.simpletimerjob, I think is the name of it. So this is what it would look like if you were navigating to it. I recommend using the Windows client for Git, GitHub, if you want to do that. You can also get every bit of this as a zip file right there. So if you just navigate to Patterns and Practices, you click Download Zip, it packages up the entire repo, and you can take the zip file with you. All right? So I actually have these solutions pulled down. Let me, come on. Open up my File Explorer, C code, Office Dev, PMP, and samples. So I'm going to go to core simple timer job right there. And we're going to look at the console version of it. All right. So when you look at this thing, it's actually fairly simple. We just have a program.cs. We've added the SharePoint context.cs and the token helper.cs. So we just copied those out of another provider-hosted app and pasted them into this project. There's a few references that we added, but for the most part, that's what we did. We have an app config here. And so I am not going to use a username and password. I'm actually wanting to use a client ID and a client secret so that it's an app. It's the app actually talking to SharePoint. I don't have to worry about the password expiring, and I can do that. So I'm going to show you. So you're like, well, how do I get the client ID? How do I get the secret? There's actually a cool little trick that I'll show you. The endpoint that we use to do this, if I go to, let me expand this so you can see it a little bit more. So if I go to underscore layouts app reg new dot aspx, this is the user interface that we use, that you can use to actually register an app and get a client ID and a client secret. When Visual Studio actually talks to SharePoint to register one of these, this is what it actually does. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to generate a client ID, generate a client secret. I'm going to call this app Moscow Timer. And the app domain really doesn't matter, but I need to fill something in. So I'm going to do, and my redirect URI just needs to be something and then while I do this, I am going to copy my client ID and my client secret, and I'm going to put them into this project. You want to treat these like a username password because these things have a lot of power with the rights that we're getting ready to go give this thing. I also want to replace that URL with the URL for my site. I'll do that here in a second. So now what I'm going to do is I'm actually going to create this. So the app identifier has been successfully created. It shows me the ID, the secret, the domain, the redirect URL. All right. So now I've registered the app, but I have not given the app any permissions yet. So I need to actually go tell SharePoint what permissions this app has. So it's a two-step process. So what I'm going to do is I'm actually going to copy this client ID again. I am going to navigate to another hidden page called appinv.aspx. And this is a page that allows you to grant permissions to an app without having to go through all the rigmarole. So what I'm going to do is just do a lookup on that app ID. It shows me the info. And then it wants the permission request XML. So the easiest way to do the permission request XML new project. I'm just going to create a SharePoint provider hosted app. We'll just call it App 1. It doesn't really matter because what I'm after is the manifest. We'll finish it. And then we will go in and configure the permissions we want. I'm just going to go give it tenant level permissions so I don't have to worry about it. But obviously you wouldn't want every app in your org to have tenant level permissions. But if I look at this app manifest, I go to permissions, and I say I want it to have tenant flow control. And then I'm going to save that. And I'm going to open this app manifest. Open with just Notepad. And then what you want is the app permission requests, that part of the XML right there. You could probably handcraft it from memory, but that's all I really needed. So then I'm going to paste that in there in the permission request XML. And so now I have registered an app. And I've trusted it to have full control of my entire tenant. All right? So here, I'm going to come into this project. I'm going to paste this because I want to talk to mine, not Vez's. Sites, Moscow, dev. That's right. All right. So now it's configured. The app is registered and has the appropriate permissions to do whatever it wants to SharePoint. So now let's look at some code. We're going to look here at the, get rid of that. So basically what we're doing is we're just grabbing that site URI. We're getting a realm from the target URL for that URI. We're going to get an access token for the URL. This is where we need the token helper. I'm getting an app-only access token. We'll talk a little bit about what that is in the next session. But and then I'm getting a client context with the access token here. And then basically what this code does, it's very simple. It just says, if this list doesn't exist called remote operation, then we want to add a list called remote operation. And then we basically want to write an entry into the list for each time this timer job actually runs. That's really what that code is doing. So super simple, but kind of gets the point across that I can manipulate and work with the SharePoint environment through the remote APIs. I've got a couple little helper methods down here for checking if the list exists and adding the list, but for the most part, it's not very much code. So now let's F5 this. Wait. Token request failed. What? What's that?
There was a slash in the beginning.
Oh, I missed it. All right, so let me stop. I will go back to my... Make sure I get the right ones. Oh, wait. Oh, you think I didn't get the whole thing? Huh. So let's abridge. Wait. Sorry. Copy paste error. It actually won't give me the client secret again, will it? I'm going to have to do it again. Sorry. Generate. Generate. Let's call this Moscow timer 2. App domain. .com. Create, and let's make sure I actually copy the whole thing. Yeah, I did miss some characters, so we're gonna, sorry, I'm gonna run through this real quick again. Oh, that was a secret. And the client ID. And I need to go give it the permissions again. So, new project, app for SharePoint, provider hosted, next, doesn't really matter, next, finish, and put in my password. App manifest permissions. I could actually, for this one, I could just give it rights to the site collection, but and open with Notepad. And grab my permission request. I need to go back over and actually copy this. App INV, ASPX. Look up that one. Moscow timer 2. Now we go back. Take my permission request, put it in here, create. Do I trust it? Yes. All right. I don't think I have any copy-paste errors this time. So let's Alt or Function F5 this guy. Access is denied. Where is my... Let me look at the context. Moscow dev. Office AMS. SharePoint.com. Office. Yeah. Let's do that. Get that out of the way. Stop. Is it picking up? Maybe I misspelled this. Let me just make sure that site's the right one. Yeah? It might need the trailing slash. All right, we're going to try it one more time, and then we will move on to something more interesting. I did something wrong. Believe me, it works. There's a Microsoft Virtual Academy video that shows a working demo. I can give you the link to that. But the point to this being, you can do timer jobs. You can only use the remote operations that we provide through the CSOM and REST APIs. All right. So with that, let's talk a little bit about user experience. So one of the ways that we have seen folks, and let me pull the slide back up from here. We've seen folks complain about not being able to brand or to inject UI into SharePoint without customizing the master pages. There is an approach that you can use to do this. Why would you say, why would you care about customizing the master pages? I have a very long podcast that I did not too long ago with Jeremy Thake on just this topic. In an on-prem world where maybe I own the updates of my server, I own when it's going to be upgraded, I own when new features are going to be added, I can plan for change. I can plan to go update my master pages everywhere when I'm doing an upgrade. In the new world of SharePoint Online, you're going to pay that tax when we introduce change. You're going to have to go change those master pages when we introduce change, okay? So a recent example has been when we changed our suite navigation. We've done it two or three times. I had a bunch of customers who had tweaked, unghosted their master page and then tweaked that control, right? Well, when we rolled out the new control, we didn't update their master page, and so it could either break or your users aren't getting new features, right? You may be willing to pay that tax for a portal site, maybe your intranet homepage. You may be willing to do that every so often, go in, update that master page. But I can guarantee you for 10,000 sites across your site, all your site collections, you are not going to want to get on that treadmill. You're a whole lot better just looking at branding from a perspective of using themes, using styles, using alternate CSS, and then using this approach, which is using a JavaScript injection with a user custom action. I will say you do need to be careful with script injection, but you can use a user custom action to programmatically add something to the host web that's available and will render on all pages in the host web. So an instance of that might be, I want to put some navigation links under the suite nav. I want to, you know, there's ways that you can use this approach. So let's make sure this demo actually works better. So I have JavaScript injection. And so what I'm going to do here, again, I just pulled this code down from PMP. I go to my, down here, it'll ask where my developer site collection is, my site URL. I just need to put that in. So every one of these samples is that way. So I'm going to grab my Moscow dev URL. I'm going to paste it in here. It'll ask me for my credentials. All right, so now it knows how to talk to my SharePoint site. So I want to look a little bit at what this app does. Let me run it and then we'll jump into the code. So I'm just going to do function F5. It is uploading, is installing. And it should launch my browser. It's going to ask me to sign in. Let's try that. But Visual Studio seems to not like that. And then it asks me, do I trust the JavaScript injection? I trust it. It's going to send me to the page for the app on my local host. And then every one of these samples, we try to actually keep very scenario focused. And we actually present the scenario to you in the app page. So you can see here it says step one, we're going to inject the JavaScript file to your current site using the button in the demo section. And then step two, check the changes by clicking back to site. Okay? And then you can see that every page will show this customized status message. So I'm going to click inject customization. I'm going to go back to site. I have now stuck that on every page in my entire site by using a JavaScript injection. Okay, I did not have to unghost my master page. I did not have to. I won't have to pay that tax to make those types of changes. Okay. Now, if I go back to my app, you can see that I can also remove it later. And if I go back to the site, it's gone. Okay. Now, what did it actually do? So if we look at button submit, we have a function that we call addJSLink. So if I go to the definition of that, basically what we're doing is we're composing a URL to where we actually want to put the scripts in the script folder. We compose the URL to the JavaScript. We use a string builder. We build a little bit of JavaScript here as we're going along, and then have a script block, convert that to string, and then existing actions, we do the web.userCustomActions. We load those, we execute the query, and then we iterate through those, and we add, if our action is not there, we add this custom action here with the location of the script link. Or if it's already there, we delete it and then we load it, is basically what we're doing. And then here's the code to actually delete it when we're done. So be careful with it. And the only reason I say be careful with it is there could be times where you want to watch what your developers are putting on every page in every site, right? I'm running in the context of the host web. I could, maybe do something with that. User visits the site, and I could go do so. You just want to be careful with it. But it is a better approach, in my opinion, than customizing your master pages everywhere just to inject some kind of a control into the site. All right. What's the next one? We did JavaScript injection. This one is very, very, very common. I don't think I've been to a large customer that did not have some sort of custom site provisioning process and some sort of site template. Requirements, right? So maybe the finance department needs certain type of site with a certain type of list that's created, over and over and over. Maybe it's a construction company and they have, team sites they create for every construction project and they want it to have certain templates and certain look and feel. Now, the way we would do that before in full trust code, anybody here using custom site definitions? Ah, yeah. I built a whole lot of sites with custom site definitions, and I had it when I was still in the field, because I could totally control and own everything, and it was awesome until I tried to move any of that to SharePoint Online. We do not support them in SharePoint Online. We will not support them in SharePoint Online. Now, there is the web template approach, using web templates in a sandbox solution, right? So that's one way that you could look at templating a site. I've actually got a blog post coming out on this real soon. Similar to the tax we talked about with master pages. If you think about web templates, there's a couple of interesting things about them in SharePoint Online. If I go provision using a web template, and I've defined the features that I want activated on that site, we in SharePoint Online then add new features. None of those features are going to show up on those sites. Now, that may be okay. You may not want those new features, but your users might. And so then you're going to have to go yourself and add those features back to all those existing sites that you've created based on those web templates. The other thing that I've notoriously found difficult, both with site definitions and with web templates, is that, yes, if I want to, you know, I'm stamping out these construction sites, you know, thousands of them a year, and then all of a sudden they decide, well, we want some new templates and we want some additional lists. Well, I can go update my web templates, and that'll work for any newly created sites. But if I want to add those features to sites that were already created, I got to write code. All right, so I got to go write something that runs somewhere that scans through all those sites that have already been previously created and adds those new features. And so I argue that similar to, I argue that if you're going to end up writing that amount of code anyway, what are you gaining by adding the web template? Why don't you just programmatically create the things you need when you provision the site? Okay. Now, it's been kind of controversial, but I've yet to have anybody give me a definitive reason why they would not want to do that. And we've actually got an XML-based site configuration engine in one of our samples that shows how you could do a similar approach to what we do with web templates, but what comes out the other side is actually just an out-of-the-box team site or an out-of-the-box that you've added customizations to. You've created list definitions, you've created document libraries, you've uploaded document templates. But as far as SharePoint Online is concerned, that's an out-of-the-box team site. And so if we add new features to the team site, or we then you will still benefit from those moving forward. It does not solve the problem of having to go back if you want to change the type of site and add new features yourself. You will still have to write code to go update all those sites. So this was actually born from a project we did internally with MSIT. At Microsoft, we let users just go create site collections. Anybody can go create site collections. Last time I checked, we actually had about 20% more site collections by number than we have employees. So we have a proliferation of SharePoint sites out there. So what we're going to go look at is there's a few provision examples on in Patterns and Practices. The one that we're going to look at is, oh wait, actually I had it in my deck. There's a few of them in here, and they do different things. So thought I had the link in there. In samples, we want site. So there's site collection creation if I'm creating site collections, and then there's subsite creation if I'm creating subsites. And we actually, I will explain why there's two different approaches here. But first, let's look at site collection creation. I want to add my URL. Actually, let's kill that. I want my I want to put it on my Moscow site. All right. So now I'll log in. Yes, you will get tired of typing in this password. Visual Studio does not save, even when you say keep me signed in. It forces a new session every single time, but hey, what are you going to do? All right, so first I will just show it to you, and then we will jump in the code. So F5. we built this self-service site provisioning engine for MSIT when we started our move to the cloud. And then we also decided that we wanted to keep, so here we have to trust it, let it have full control of all the site collections. It does need tenant admin level control to be able to use the site collection provisioning APIs that we provide with SharePoint Online. So what we've got here is I've got three different quote unquote templates that we've defined. I'll show you what those templates are here in just a minute. I want to give it a name. I want to call it, my Moscow site. And we will call it Moscow site. Give it a description. This is my description. And we're just going to do a team site. And since this does take a little bit of time, we're really working on it. So you'll find a few little nuggets like that in there. We try to have a little fun with it. But for MSIT, what we ended up doing was, at first, we were just provisioning all the site collections in the cloud. But then we had a notable number of site collections that had to stay on-prem for various different reasons. They were using features like BI features that did not work in the cloud yet. And so we still needed to be able to create sites on-prem as well. And so we actually had a design change request to the product in April CU. If you have on-prem SharePoint 2013, if you have April CU applied, you can actually use the CSOM APIs just like you do for Microsoft Online or SharePoint Online against your on-prem farm. So before, what we were having to do is we would deploy a custom WCF service and then we would call that from our provider-hosted app. So that allowed us to actually use the same API surface both on-prem and in the cloud. And so depending on what type of site somebody created, like if you look at that template, there, maybe one of those is a BI site, right? And that needs to be created in an on-prem farm. I can use this same pattern to create sites on-prem or to create them in the cloud, okay? Site collection creation in SharePoint Online takes a long time sometimes. And so I'm going to let that run, though, and we're going to look at the code while it's running. Subsite creation goes much faster, and I'm going to show that one, too. All right, so if you look at create site collection, there's some goop up here, but it's really not that interesting. But you can see that we're adding some list items here. You could drive this through a database. You could drive this through an XML file. But we're just programmatically injecting them. This is setting up that UI. But here's where the real magic happens. I'm saying I get a SharePoint context, right? My new web URL, I create a user client context for SP host, and then I do create site collection. This is where the real magic happens. We created this little helper method. So I'm going to go to the definition of that. And so basically what we're doing there is the first part's not that interesting. It's just plumbing. And then we're establishing our path to our admin site collection. So you actually have to talk to the tenant admin site collection to do site collection provisioning in SharePoint Online. And then we get a realm from that target URL. We get an app-only access token. And then once we get that, we come down here. We say new site creation properties. We set the URL, the owner, the title, the template that we want to use, and that's the out-of-the-box template, so one of our templates that we provide. The storage level, the user code max level, all right, and then we do tenant.create site, and then execute query. So at that point, it's going to create the site. This is an asynchronous process, okay? Site collection creation in SharePoint Online sometimes can take multiple minutes, right? It depends on how many other people are provisioning on that piece of infrastructure at the same time. It's basically an async queue. The hacky workaround that we have right here is we're just sleeping and then checking to see if it's there, sleeping, checking to see if it's there. there is a sample for doing a workflow-based site provisioning sample in here as well, so that basically we just write a list entry, and then periodically we go check, and then once the site's been created, we'll send an email to the user, hey, your site's been created, okay? So there is a way that, you know, this is just so we can keep it nice and simple in this one pattern and show it all in this app.
Can I ask a question?
Yes, absolutely you can.
I would like to know if your input differs very much from what you write in the custom, say, templates, the web templates, from the kernel that developers may already have ready.
Yeah.
Can you parse it somehow and translate it into your input?
That's actually a great question. I would love for that feature request to come into user voice.
Okay.
I've had that exact comment made, because people tell me, they're like, hey, we have this huge investment in all this plumbing, you know, this declarative stuff that we've built. We don't want to have to go write all that code. Can you help us? And so I'm trying to build support within the engineering team for us to actually do just that. The best way I can build support is if a whole lot of people go ask for that in user voice. Okay? So this has been a recent thing that we've been really touting to folks, because I get about a third of my job, I deal with large angry customers calling us because we broke them. Now I may be a little skewed towards, you know, the angry customer, because no happy customers land in cat land, and maybe there are multiple millions of customers who are happily running web templates in SharePoint Online, but I kind of doubt it. Based on the support volume we get when we roll out certain kinds of changes. And so that's really where this guidance is coming from. We're not saying you can't do it. We're just trying to be very clear that you will be in a better position in the long term. So I'd love to see the request on user voice. You know, if you do social networking, get all your friends to go vote for it. Oh, I didn't say that. We don't want to game the stats. We'd never do that. But I would love to see it come up into my stack rank, so every Thursday we sit and go through those things. So.
I know one community project that is implementing something like that.
Ah?
Yes, it's called SP Meta 2.
Ah, I've heard of that one.
You've
yes.
Heard of that.
Yeah.
So they are already considering that for something like
Yeah, and I love the community. I mean, that's the thing. I mean, you see how we're doing patterns and practices. We're very much trying to involve the community. The engineering team can't do everything, right? How did SharePoint 2007 take off and get so popular and strong? Because when that thing came out, I mean, you would hit F1, and it would say insert documentation here. I mean, there was not a lot of documentation. There was not a lot of, you know, our software limits and boundaries guidance wasn't out there. You know, there was a lot of common controls and stuff that people wanted, and the community jumped in. We got things like SPCAF. We got, you know, there's lots of community projects, and so we built this huge community around it. We have that opportunity to do that again. And I look at it as an opportunity, but some folks don't, you know. We can't do everything. I'd love to see the community step in, but I'd also love to see it on user voice. But you can see it actually created the site. It applied a template, you know, to the site, or a theme to the site. If you look at some of these other ones, you can see, and we'll come back down here, and I'll show, once we've got that, here we're doing set theme based on name. So here's an orange theme, right? But on some of these other, you could do anything you want, right? So based on the templates, you could say, hey, I need to create libraries, I need to upload document templates, you know, all those things that I can do through CSOM, I can do this way too.
Anything the API
provides, that's right. I do want to take a look at subsite creation, because that is a little bit different. Why you ask? and I actually have a design change request for this, but I have not gotten it through the ads cuts yet. To do custom site provisioning in SharePoint Online, you basically have a setting in Tenant Admin that you can go into, and you can say, I want to use custom site provisioning, and so any site provisioning request, send it to this URL, and you just put the URL of your provider-hosted app. Pretty cool for creating site collections when somebody wants to create a site collection. Problem is, the new site for creating a subsite doesn't respect that setting. And so this is one of those rare occasions where you will hear me espouse that it's okay to go find that thing in the DOM and switch the URL out. That's basically what I'm doing in this this sample. So if we come down here and we look, actually let me set my site collection up. Cancel that because I need to change my URL to moscow.dev. And so the JavaScript injection approach that I showed you guys before, we're basically using this approach to hijack the new site link and create and replace it with a link to our app, so that we can own the subsite provisioning. Okay. So if I F5 this, and it's installing. This one doesn't take near as long. The subsite creation does not go through the site collection provisioning pipeline. So do I trust the subsite creation app? Yes, I trust it. I'm working on it. What's that?
Not really working, just working on it.
Just working on it. That was the out-of-the-box one. The really working on it was our app. So so it looks very similar to what we had in the other. Okay. I have team, super team, uber team. Let's try super team because we did a team before. And we're going to call this subsite. Subsite. And create. Now we're really working on it. we were joking around. We were going to get really creative and just say working on it, and then after a few seconds say really working on it, and then after 10 seconds say no, really, really, we're working on it. But we figured this, we're really working hard on it. So boom, there, that subsite got created. And you can tell that we've applied our theme to the site. Now, the interesting thing here is if I go to site contents, look where my new subsite link is. Localhost. So it's sending it to my custom provisioning app as opposed to the out-of-the-box just template creation. Yeah. You could. So that list that we put in there, you know, team site, Uber team, whatever, if I wanted to, I could just put the out-of-the-box templates in there, right? And there's actually methods to get all the available web templates as well. So there's actually a pattern. There's a sample in there for doing that. So you could totally do that. You could just say, hey, yeah, you want to create out-of-the-box ones? That's great. And, you know, that's fine, too. How do we do that? I want to show you real quick. If we look at our subsite creation app web and pages, default.aspx, it's always the first place to start digging. You can see here, actually this is all just loading the Chrome control for the app page. Not that much interest there, but if you look at it looks very similar to that last one, except we have a create subsite method. The create subsite method actually creates a subsite, and it returns a web. So you can see we're taking the same approach, but instead of a site collection, it's actually a subsite. But then look here, add JS link. So same thing we saw before. That's how we're injecting the JavaScript in to actually hijack that new site creation link. So, all right. And again, we have provisioning is one of those things where we've gotten so many different questions and so many different patterns that customers use. You know, people would always tell me, "Well, why doesn't Microsoft just create a really cool, you know, customizable site collection and subsite provisioning engine?" And it's because there are too many variations of what customers are trying to do, just to be blunt, for us to think that we could nail it or get something that was going to get the use cases. So you can see that represented here by all of the different types of provisioning samples we have in patterns and practices. So one of the biggest ones, though, if you look at solutions, provisioning.hybrid. Now this one's a lot. There's a lot of projects, a lot of solutions, but we actually have that's the project I was telling you about. You can provision in online and you can provision in on-prem. That's the most complete provisioning sample that we have there. So, all right. So we've talked about provisioning. And where are we at on time? This thing, we got till 3:45, so we've got some time. So OneDrive governance and branding. We hear this a lot. People are like, well, you know, maybe I want to add some folders into people's OneDrives. Maybe I want to put a policy document into people's OneDrives. We hear that for some reason a lot, you know, usage and guidelines kind of stuff. Maybe we want to set everybody's theme to their OneDrive site to be the same, right? We've got a custom theme. If you know how OneDrive provisioning works, up until recently, we only had the ability for the OneDrive sites to be created when a user navigated to it. Well, they would get the out-of-the-box blue theme, and then how are you going to make sure they don't go change it to be some wacky theme, you know, cat pictures, whatever. Maybe you want to enforce that that common look and feel that you have for your intranet is also applied to these OneDrive sites. The interesting thing is, based on the fact that we lacked the ability to pre-create my sites, personal sites, we saw a lot of really crafty folks doing things like UI automation to go pre-create them. Because, you know, you turn 40,000 people loose on a new tenant, and they click it, the provisioning pipeline backs up, and then they get frustrated, and then they call the help desk, and then they wonder why their OneDrive site, and you're like, hey, wait 24 hours. It's not a good experience. And we all knew this from running big SharePoint implementations on-prem. You would pre-create the personal sites. So we actually now have an API for pre-creating the personal sites. So if you have not seen that, that's there in, I believe, April CU as well. So there's been some improvements there. We have a sample and patterns and practices for how to pre-create these things. So that's a cool add that came out of our engagements with customers and listening to user voice. So why is OneDrive different? We already talked about the on-demand. And also users are site collection administrators of the OneDrive sites. So you can try as you might to, you know, hide links and do things like that, but a really crafty user is going to be able to go in there, they're going to be able to change their theme, they're going to be able to do, you can't remove their site collection owner rights without crippling their OneDrive. And so having some sort of a governance job that runs and makes sure that the theme is set or any of the settings that they've gone and set maybe get set back is something that I've seen a lot of customers want to do. The other thing that I've seen on the OneDrive governance side in MSIT, when we went to SharePoint Online and our OneDrive sites were in SharePoint Online, users would call the help desk because they had problems with their OneDrive for Business site. Well, that help desk tech could not access that person's OneDrive site. They weren't site collection administrators, so they couldn't go in and see what the user had done or what they had broken. Couldn't debug it, couldn't troubleshoot it. And so we actually built an app that allows, it's part of that site provisioning app. We call it a help desk enabler. And what it does is when a user calls, instead of the help desk agent having to talk the user through, hey, go add me to your site collection as an admin, hopefully they get it right, and then that help desk agent logging in, and then the user having to go remove it later, we just wrote an app that does that. So the help desk guy can put in the user's alias, it gets the URL to their OneDrive site, it programmatically goes and adds the help desk agent as a an admin on the site collection. They can then help the person. When the help desk ticket is done, it actually removes those permissions and it audit logs all of this so that you know, we could see if any rogue help desk agents are going and adding themselves to, you know, Satya's OneDrive site or anything like that. So that's another creative way to think about governance, because we just saw a lot of help desk call volume and a lot of support costs to that, and so there was a lot of value to writing that app, that governance app. So I've got a couple of OneDrive governance and branding samples. This one here is actually one of the easier ones, so we're going to use that one. And just to show you where this is at. So this is OneDrive for Business Branding Customization. This is actually for branding the OneDrive site. Okay, so now we'll actually go pull it up. So we used to have, for those of you who knew about Office AMS before it became Patterns and Practices, you can see Office AMS in a lot of those places in our documentation. We're trying to get that cleaned up, but that's what this project used to be called. The marketing guys thought it was awesome, and they said, let's make it Patterns and Practices. So that's how it came to be. All right, so what we have here, I need to do the same thing that I did before. Actually, it's on this one. For the OneDrive customizer, I'm going to pick my Moscow Dev site as the site URL that I'm going to point to. Actually, I may need to do this one to the tenant admin site. Let me look at the code real quick. Ah, okay. All right, this should work. And we'll F5 this guy. And while it's installing, It went ahead and went fast enough. All right. So do we trust the OneDrive customizer? Of course, because it came from Patterns and Practices. Oh, wait a minute. I actually know what that is, but let me just look at the code here real quick. I have another one that might be more interesting. Hold on. Registers a script block. That inherits from system.uid page. All right, let me look at a different one for you. OneDrive document migration. That's a biggie. So this one actually is not a good sample either. All right, so I'm 0 for I got 3 of them that worked and 2 of them that didn't. I apologize. Let's throw one out there to the audience. Something I haven't covered, something that you think is going to be challenging in your full trust code, and let's see if I can answer it in the next 10 minutes. Anybody got one? No? Oh, well, that's, that one's going to be very difficult. I don't have a sample for that one yet. But we'll keep working on that one. So we actually have an interesting one that I have seen a lot of folks customizing master pages for. Back to my try not to customize your master pages where you can. We did some telemetry and did some looking at a bunch of master pages and saw that quite often what people were trying to do was actually just set some alternate CSS and site logo. You could not do that through the API. And so we've actually added those things to the API. I think it was the August CU that these showed up in the on-prem space, and it would have been the August timeframe where they showed up in SharePoint Online. But you now have the ability to do alternate CSS and site logo through the client-side object model. So that's going to give you a lot of capability to brand the site in addition to themes without having to unghost that master page and customize it. So this one I will actually... here. You could do that too, right? There's crafty workarounds, but people don't think, oh, I need to inject JavaScript so that then I could load some CSS. There's an alternate CSS property on the web. Why don't we just expose it? So, but yeah, you're right. There's other crafty workarounds for that. Let me switch this to Moscow. And F5.
It's deploying. This dry air is really getting me.
Come on. It's installing, it's uploading, updated the web config, installation in progress. Come on. And do we trust it? Of course we trust it. And you can see here it lines out the scenario. We want to set the alternate CSS and a custom logo to the host site. So I want to run it. Oh my God. Oh, I don't have the new set of client libraries that actually have the method on there. So that's my fault for not doing this. This is my Surface Pro 3, and I have been starting to use this recently. So, but believe me, it does exist. You do need the, so if you go to, if you just go search for download SharePoint client libraries, you can download them. You want to get the most recent ones, and then these things show up there. So, but it's actually fairly straightforward if we look at the code. I actually want the code. I'm going to get down to the... So we have an upload assets to host web. So that's where we're actually uploading our contoso.css and a PNG file into the site assets folder. And then we do web.alternate CSS URL and web.site logo URL, web.update. It's that simple. So, but you do need the most recent client libraries on your machine. So. With that, I'm going to leave the last 5 minutes for questions. I'm happy to dig around a little bit more in these patterns and practices. If folks have specific questions, though, I'd like to take them if we have them. No? I got one in the back. All right, hold on. No, go ahead. Lifecycle
support.
Lifecycle support for custom site. Okay.
What should I do if I must update existing sites in production web? Should I develop special event receivers, or I can change existing code and put update solution in my SharePoint? What code? Full trust code or what? Full trust.
full trust code. So I would not recommend. I mean, if you're on prem and you're using full trust code, and so I think if I understand your question, you want to be able to upgrade those custom sites that you've deployed.
Yes.
You're probably using site definitions or you're using web templates, right?
Yes, I am. If I develop concrete solution, mm-hmm. I should use the versions, upgrade features, and other.
That's right.
What should I use in online?
Okay, mm-hmm. I get it now. So what we did for MSIT, and actually it's going to get expanded into our provisioning and governance sample. What we did is, when we provision site collections, we actually write them into an Azure table. We have basically a site directory that we're maintaining, and we stamp what template it was, you know, who the site owner is, and a few other properties. And then we also wrote a console job that goes and pulls. So if somebody creates something like out of band of our provisioning app, we'll pick it up, right? So that way we have a nice centralized place of all my site collections. And then what we do is we have basically a timer job that runs every so often that goes and does governance tasks on those sites. So we hooked into that to do our upgrades is what we did. So when we have a new version of our custom finance template, then what we do is we upload, you know, we have a diff basically of going from version 1 to version 2. We have code to do that. And then we just have that governance job when it runs through, execute that code against those sites. So depending on the template and the version, right? But we do have to manage that ourselves. But it's no different than managing those farm solutions that you're doing before. So does that answer your question? Yeah? Great. You had one over here?
When you write for the extension required on Primus, do you have a thing called
that is the number one most common ask that I get. Can I get my darn ULS logs? Because I did it for years and years. I developed on SharePoint. Something goes wrong. I go dig through the ULS logs. I look at the stack trace. I figure out what's wrong. I am working with the Office Developer Platform team. We have tried multiple times to get the team who owns that in SharePoint to come up with a way to provide those. Right now, the answer is you have to call support, and I know that's a horrible story. It really is. What we did do, though, was we wrote tooling so that the frontline support engineers can take a correlation ID, put it into this tool, and it will get the logs, and they can scrub them. So the problem is, and this is just me being open and honest with you, the problem is those ULS logs have a ton of data about our internal systems in there. And so we have to write something that can scrub that out, and you know, there's work we need to do. We can't just turn on developer dashboard. We can't, you know, just give you, because it could disclose a lot of information about our internal architecture, our systems, our server names, you know, things of that nature. So that makes our security guys really, really nervous. And so the answer, I guess the best thing you could do to help prioritize that, besides get out on User Voice and vote that thing up, it's actually pretty high up there right now, open those support tickets. Because let me explain to you, I run a process called Red Zone in the engineering team. It's myself and a bunch of the supportability PMs, where we create what we call the Pareto of Pain. And what it is it looks at the volume of support calls in particular areas, and then the engineering team has to own a solution for how do we reduce those support calls. And you and I both know that if we all call support asking for ULS logs, that will pop up on my Pareto of Pain, and I will have more ammo to get the engineering team to get us a better answer. But I don't want an answer just for SharePoint. If you look at our future for the Office 365 APIs, we need this story across the entire suite. You can't do that in Exchange either. Now, most people don't program against Exchange, but now you can, right? So the approach that we're looking to take is probably to define some O365 level service that you could use, and then each workload would implement their telemetry behind that. So that's the high-level hand-wavy design we're looking at. I know that doesn't answer your question for the next couple of months or whatever, but I have made 3 hard runs at the team who owns the dev dashboard and ULS logging to try to get this, and I'm stopped by security every single time. So.
Can you also share your understanding of the role and the future of health and logging databases on-prem, and how it can or cannot be useful as a development for Office 365? Will there be something like that in Office 365, or can you?
We use it in Office 365 actually ourselves.
Yeah.
So we do use it. We have a lot of telemetry besides just that, but that's another one of those places where, you know, maybe we don't want to show all those things, you know, to end users.
You could implement some sort of filters for
right.
data loss prevention. The leak prevention.
Exactly.
In that database and in a front end for it.
Yeah, I know of no near-term plans to do that, but that's another one of those things where, one, I'd be interested in the use case, like where you would gain a lot of value out of it. Two, I'd like to see it on user voice, and let's see how many other people think that's a valid feature as well. So I've heard that from one other person before. You're only the second person who's ever brought that up to me about wanting to do that in SharePoint Online. So.
And on-premise, will there be any developments with that database?
Well, I can say that we have not changed that schema and anything in the service, and we are shipping on-prem out of the service. So I don't know of any investments that we're making in that space right now that would accrue to the next version of on-prem. That doesn't mean it's not happening. It means I don't know about it. So if you'd want to at-mention me in the Yammer group, after I get back from Barcelona, I can go chase down the PM who owns that and just see if they have any plans. But, you know, I have not heard any whispers that there's anything groundbreaking coming on that front. So, all right, we're already about 3 minutes long. I appreciate it, guys. I hope you got at least some patterns, some approaches, and a place to go to find really cool code samples that almost all the time work if I had the right packages on my machine. So thanks a lot, and I'll be back here in about 12 minutes to do the next session. Thanks.